Back together again, you and I chatting it up and starting off a brand new week, wrapping up September, Monday, September 30th, 2024 on Connecticut Today. I started the show wondering if many Americans know about the number of criminal illegal aliens currently in the U.S. CBS News correspondent Robert Berger joined us live from Jerusalem to chat about the current tense situation in the Middle East. Yankee Institute Director of Policy and Research David Fleming broke down a new study on the current fiscal guardrails being adhered to so far by the state. And Connecticut News Junkie columnist and Substack.com blogger Terry Cowgill talked about a developing problem with Connecticut's marijuana marketplace.
So I have told you numerous times over and over and over and over and over again, and I'm not the first guy to do this, or gal for that matter, guy or gal. I'm not the first guy or person to do this, to alert you to the fact that when somebody has to, I guess by law, or there's something burning they've got to get done, and there's information that they have to get out, when do they do it? What have I told you? And I hopefully this is one of the things that you've kind of learned from me listening over the years here, at least 5 years here, and I've gone back, you know, 20, 30 years doing talk here. Friday night, late Friday afternoon, Friday night. Because a lot of people simply aren't paying attention. Their minds are fried. They're torched after a week at work. Maybe it's been a bad week at home with the hubby or the wifey or the kids or whatever. So Friday night, a lot of people just say, that's it. I've had it. My mind is toasted. I want to have a couple of drinks. I want to go to the bar and play darts. Or I want to go to a hockey game tonight. Or going to sit home and pass out on the couch and watch something on Netflix. So you know where I'm coming from on this. So I don't know whether you saw this, but late on, I think it was late Thursday or Friday, some numbers came out that should be frightening. And again, I ain't telling you who to vote for in a few weeks after Election Day. That's not what I'm here for. I can tell you what my opinion is on the candidates and the various parties and how they tackle, you know, big dollar, big kind of sexy topics. And one of those topics is immigration. Now, one side, the Republican side, the conservative side, tends to look at it strictly from a law enforcement aspect, right? Hey, our borders are being violated. There's no reason why, for example, we should allow the number of people into this country that we do when we have an immigration system in place, a system that's been in place for decades, albeit an expensive system, but nonetheless, it's there. And there are a lot of people, hundreds of thousands every year, who have a dream of becoming American citizens, and a lot of them do that. You don't hear too much about them because it's really not sexy. The media doesn't like to cover that. And then you have people who think they have the right to violate our borders. And now the other side of the aisle will say, well, can you blame them because their countries are in such bad shape? Well, all right, maybe, I guess. And then there are numbers that we see late in the week, last week, that primarily started getting some circulation on Friday that you will be astounded by. I'm not talking about wildly bemused by. I'm not talking about, that's kind of interesting. No, no, no. I'm talking about a scenario where the Immigration and Customs Enforcement people, ICE, sent some figures to a member of Congress, a Republican House member named Tony Gonzalez, that are absolutely frightening. And this should be, these numbers that I'm about to give you should be maybe the only major issue. And I know I'm acting a little Pollyanna-ish here, but for my money, this is the major issue that you should be looking at when you decide who you're going to vote for. And the thing is, it's got these numbers I'm going to give you, and I'll do that momentarily. These numbers I'm going to give you have nothing to do with wanting a better life. These numbers have nothing to do with escaping oppression. These numbers have nothing to do with escaping religious persecution. These numbers have little or nothing to do with escaping drug gangs. A lot of these numbers have to do with crooks and with criminality. And you remember, I guess it was in the first time he ran in 2016, Donald Trump caught a lot of flack for saying that a lot of people that come over the border aren't the best. They are criminals. They are rapists. They are gang members. And everybody in the media said, oh, my God, how can you say that? Well, let's play a little game, shall we? We're going to take a quick break here, a quick timeout to do a little business. And when I come back, I'm simply going to read you numbers, not from Fox News or Newsmax or some, you know, something you would call right wing. No, I'm going to read you numbers from the Immigration and Customs Enforcement people. And then we'll play a little game. You decide. The situation in the Middle East, starting late last week and evolving over the weekend, is changing almost hourly here. Joining us live from Jerusalem, CBS News correspondent Robert Berger is with us. And Robert, it certainly sounds like this thing is fluid here almost by the minute here. Thanks for joining us. What is the very latest in Jerusalem?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the news just changing as we go along. Right now, according to U.S. officials, and also pictures I'm seeing on my TV screen from Israel's northern border, Israel is conducting limited operations on the ground in South Lebanon against Hezbollah. And this is just raising the ante even further after Israel assassinated top Hezbollah leaders. Now, there are ground forces going in, although it is a limited operation.
Robert, has any of this changed the dynamic that we've seen play out, and you've, of course, seen of play it out over the past several months, of the support for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, how he's conducting all this, the efforts to get the hostages back? Is this coalescing support around him, or are there still plenty of critics?
I think both. Obviously, Netanyahu has plenty of critics since October 7th. The intelligence disaster of allowing that Hamas terrorist attack almost a year ago now. But, you know, he has, according to polls, he has been gaining some support recently because right now, Israel, over the past 2 weeks, the tide has kind of turned in the battle against Lebanon, against Hezbollah in Lebanon, which has been firing rockets in solidarity with Hamas in Gaza for a year. There were the explosion of the pagers and the walkie-talkies that injured and killed a bunch of Hezbollah operatives in Lebanon. Just over the weekend, Israel assassinated Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah. These are seen by the wider Israeli public as successes, and that is helping Netanyahu somewhat, although, he certainly has plenty of opponents here in Israel.
Couple more minutes here with Robert Berger, CBS News, Jerusalem. Robert, I know the president, Mr. Biden, came out a few days ago and said, listen, you know, and I don't know his exact words, but he applauded the taking out of Nasrallah in a roundabout way. Do we know if the U.S. is helping here, Robert? I know we're not saying much, but is there help with intelligence here and imaging and things like that? Do we know that or not?
Well, let's put it, what we do know is that America was very quick to say after the assassination of this Hezbollah leader and also the explosion of the pagers, in which several thousand pagers exploded at the same time in mostly in Beirut, but all over Lebanon, and injured thousands of Hezbollah operatives. The U.S. was very quick to say, oh, you know, it's not us. We weren't involved. As far as intelligence, I would think that over the past year, and in general, the U.S. Does help Israel with intelligence. But overall, these things like the assassination of the Hezbollah leader over the weekend in Beirut, that is Israel's Mossad spy agency, and probably the U.S. didn't really know this was going to happen.
Yeah, finally, Robert, on that exploding pager and then the walkie-talkie thing, I mean, a lot of us who watch this stuff, you've covered this for years, but I can't tell you how many of my callers here, Robert, to the station were like, wow. I mean, we've seen Israeli intelligence triumphs and payback sort of raids, but, you know, when a lot of us saw this, and I'm wondering if you had the same reaction to this, I mean, that thing with the pagers and the two-way radios was just, I mean, it was wow. It was out of a Tom Clancy novel.
Right. I mean, even better, maybe. I mean, how did the Israelis actually think of doing this? That's one. Two, how did they pull it off? I mean, you're talking about basically intercepting or actually manufacturing thousands of beepers or pagers and, mm-hmm. you know, selling them to Hezbollah, getting them in the system, and then blowing them up simultaneously. Really amazing. Yeah. The Mossad and then the killing of the Hezbollah leader in his bunker in Beirut on Friday. I mean, the Mossad right now is going back to its legendary image, I would say.
Robert Berger, CBS News, Jerusalem. Robert, thank you. Take care and be safe, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
Well, if you listen to this show, if you listen to Melissa in the Morning, if you listen to Lisa Wexler, and as Bridget Quinn joins us here on WICC, you hear about the fiscal guardrails, in other words, spending limits, the way things have to be spent and can't be spent out of the general budget in Hartford. And our friends at the Yankee Institute have released a new study contending that with the budget discipline that has been in place for about the past 8 years or so, last time when the Democrats and the Republicans in Hartford shared power, particularly in the state Senate, the state has saved a whole lot of money. David Fleming joins us right now. Dave is Director of Policy and Research at the Yankee Institute. Good to have him back on the show. Dave, good afternoon. How are you, sir?
Doing well, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on. And this new report is kind of cool. I'll put this up on my Facebook page. So, Dave, for a lot of people who may have heard the phrase bandied about on shows like mine and in the news, they hear, well, the fiscal guardrails, like they kind of have an idea of what this is. But before we get into what your report shows, Dave, explain what the guardrails are to my audience once again.
Certainly, yes. And I think it bears just mentioning that the guardrails were a series of budgetary rules that were passed in 2017, which directed a portion of Connecticut's incoming revenue into the budget reserve fund, which could then be used to pay down Connecticut's debt on its public pensions, which taxpayers are legally on the hook for.
So again, as I said in your promo in your appearance here a few months ago, so bottom line is, Dave, that if we exercise some fiscal stability and restraint, I guess the eventual good of this, besides paying down our long-term debt, is it makes it easier, if we want to hold the line on taxes.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think I've heard some comments online and on some other radio shows that many people are frustrated with where the money is being spent. And I can certainly understand that, being Connecticut being a pretty high tax state. And sometimes there are government services that may not be funded as much as they could be, perhaps. But I'd like to make the case that it's more important that we pay down the debt now so that we can invest in those types of things later.
So I guess you folks in Yankee, Dave, came up with a roundabout number as far as what this has saved the state so far. So talk a little, Dave Fleming, about the numbers involved here.
Yeah. So far, we've saved, because we implemented the guardrails in 2017, we saved about $175 million, which we could have, if we had not saved that amount of money, we could be thinking about tax hike potentially. if we were in that fiscal trouble.
So how were you able to come, you and the folks at Yankee, Dave, how are you able to come to this figure here? Get into that a little, if you could.
Oh, sure. Yes. And so we partnered with Reason Foundation, and they're really the bones behind the framework of what our study is all about. And they did most of the analysis because in many ways, I mean, it takes years and decades to really get the expertise to really tackle this issue adequately. And I mean, I'm a somewhat of a generalist on some issues. And this was something that we really wanted to make sure we got right. Mm-hmm. So we got the analysis right. And the Reason Foundation, they were able to find some actuaries, you know, that the people who are very specialized in figuring out exact in terms of drawing out the costs into the future and seeing if what we've saved so far at the moment is going to be adequate enough for those future costs.
David Fleming is the guest, Director of Policy and Research at the Yankee Institute. So a savings since 2017, over 7 years, of about, as you say, $170 million in change here. And I guess, David, the advantage of this is that the more we save, the less we have to spend on tax increases, and also we can pay down our debt further, right, which saves us money on, you know, whether it's your credit card or your car loan. Everybody understands on saving money that would have to go to interest, right?
Exactly. And that's kind of what happened in a worst case scenario, you know, about 10, 15 years ago with Connecticut having to raise taxes in part because we were having to pay more and more of the budget toward paying down the pension debt every year, because Connecticut is legally obligated to pay for its teachers and employees for their retirement, and those teachers and employees, they're not getting a free ride. They're contributing a certain amount each year, usually about 2 to 8% toward their pensions, in the hopes that upon retirement they'll have something to go on. So it's not as if they're getting a complete free ride here, and it's really a matter of how we're thinking about this in terms of just making sure that they're taken care of, while at the same time making sure that taxpayers are protected in the future. For example, if we were to hit a recession, mm-hmm. Let's say in the next 5 years or so, then the minimum mandatory payment toward the pensions that would balloon, because we're no longer getting interest on the investments. Oftentimes, when you hit a recession, your investments will fall in value. So somehow you have to make that up, and oftentimes that is from the taxpayers will have to do that. Now, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, but the critics of this, David, and you alluded to this earlier, say, well, this is all well and good, but our organization, our charity, is that we depend on some money from the state. And yeah, we understand the need to save money here and save on interest and pay down our debt. But there are organizations, right, who maybe want a little more leeway here, because they say these guardrails are preventing them from getting adequate funding.
Right. And I suppose I would question in terms of what they would consider adequate. And I think that there is difficulty in measuring the effectiveness of some programs sometimes, in terms of, well, everyone wants money and they talk about all this good that they're doing. But I would say that it's especially important to be good fiscal stewards of our funding. And if we maintain these guardrails, if we just do it for another, the best case scenario, the next 14 years, we can have the pensions back to a 100% funded ratio, so mm-hmm. that we're no longer throwing money at this thing. And that, at that point, we can start potentially to think about tax cuts or funding these other programs. But in the meantime, it's much more important that we actually are paying down the debt.
David Fleming is Director of Policy and Research for the Yankee Institute, and the new Yankee Institute, according along with the Reason Foundation, put out a new survey, or rather a new study, that says so far we've saved over $170 million by sticking to the so-called fiscal and financial guardrails in budgeting. Hey, David, thanks. Great to have you on again. We appreciate it, and we'll chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. David Fleming there. And to many of you, the price of cannabis-based products might be something that matters. Now, I have been living a life clean and free of intoxicants for about 40 years. But I know there are some of you folks out there who like a little gummy every now and then, who like to, as that song used to say, take it one toke over the line, sweet Jesus. One toke over the line. Listen, you're an adult, I get it, but our next guest has noticed something about cannabis prices here in the state. And not that I would be concerned about that personally, but it could be costing the state revenue. Terry Cowgill joins us. Mr. Cowgill, good afternoon. How are you?
Well, not bad. You know, and I must say that cannabis prices do not affect me either.
That's good.
Currently living in Texas, where cannabis is illegal, unless you can get a medical excuse.
Yeah.
And those are very difficult to come by.
Are they really?
So, yeah, they are. They're very strict about it here in Texas. And, you know, they're instituting a lot of different things that I've been reading about. Like, if you want to go on to one of those free porn sites now, you have to verify your age.
Yeah,
you know, which has all the porn sites really up in arms about this. But no, Texas is a different place than Connecticut. You couldn't get two states more different, actually.
No, but you've adapted well. And again, you still have your Connecticut roots. You still own property, which is a good thing. Now, you pointed this out to me, and I found this fascinating. And Terry, I remember talking about this when we were in the middle of the legalize it thing, and a lot of my discussion was, and I read a lot of things, there's kind of a sweet spot for pricing here and taxation and everything. So what's the big thing bubbling up right now between Connecticut prices and, say, Massachusetts?
Yeah, well, the problem is in Connecticut has a supply problem. And, of course, anytime supply is limited, the price goes up. Although many people who work in government don't really understand that, I don't want to paint with a broad brush. Not everybody who works in government is like this, but an astonishing number of people, percentage of people who work in government, really don't understand markets. So what happened was when Connecticut legalized, they did not license enough growers. So, you know, you had this situation where you had a high demand and you had not that much product, certainly not enough product. So the price shot up. And, you know, they've got a problem in Connecticut with grow facilities because really it's a small state. There isn't a whole lot of land on which you can build a grow facility.
Yeah.
You know, it's really, you know, it's two reasons. There's lack of land and then also, you know, nobody wants one of those facilities near them because there's a period of about a month in the spring when the flowers are blossoming and it smells awful. I don't even want to tell you what it smells like. It's horrible.
Is it really? Yeah. I've never been to a marijuana. Is it really? Wow.
Yeah, it is. And that's one of the, you know, there were lots of these things in up in the Berkshires when I was a journalist up there.
Yeah.
Lots of these applications. And that was one of the main complaints that was cited. And so odor control is a huge issue for these growers. But anyway, so that's a big problem. And, of course, what happens is now Connecticut is losing out on a lot of revenue because people are driving up to Springfield and Holyoke and Great Barrington and places like that. And they're paying like half the price for the same product. And then the other thing it does, of course, is it drives people to the black market in Connecticut, and black market, the black market's much cheaper too. So what's going to happen is the state is going to see a revenue shortfall because of sluggish sales, and some people are going to be scratching their heads going, gee, why is this? Well, you're just not selling enough product because you're not making enough of it, and that should be pretty simple to understand.
You know, Terry, I also thought, and you know, you were following this too, when this whole legalization thing happened, I'm like, well, all right, fine, if the people want it, if the General Assembly wants it. But, you know, Terry, this whole thing was made out to be some panacea here, in my opinion, in my humble opinion. It was made out to be some panacea here. We're going to say we're sorry for the over-policing. It's going to be all these great new economic opportunities. And, you know, I don't see it yet. And now to the point where you probably saw this story, Governor Lamont had to step in and Sean Scanlon had a state comptroller saying, hey, we need a lot more regulation as to how some of these marijuana funds are used. And, you know, Terry, you and I always hear from the governor and everybody how smart the people are of Connecticut. Yet we could see these problems coming, one of the ones you just talked about, from a mile away here.
Yeah, and, you know, they also had to the Social Equity Council or whatever it's called, mm-hmm. that is a part of the state's cannabis program that awards licenses to historically disadvantaged groups or groups that have been victimized by harsh drug laws. That thing has left a lot to be desired, that mm-hmm. particular committee or division of the cannabis growing department. And I believe heads have rolled in that agency as well. So it's you know, there's always going to be growing pains, but it's not like Connecticut was Colorado, which was the first state to legalize it, mm-hmm. and had to really start from scratch. We had plenty of examples and models to go by,
yep.
and we still screwed it up. So figure, go figure.
Gee, maybe I'm wrong to say the state should buy out UI and Eversource and get out of the power generating business, but I digress. Hey, Terry, the big debate coming up tomorrow night. How quickly do you think we're going to hear an allusion to eating cats and dogs? What do you think about that?
Yeah,
Terry?
Well, that'll occur fairly early on, I would say. I think Governor Walz will find a way to work that in as soon as he possibly can. This is a case of two, in my view, thoroughly unlikable individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not unusual for vice presidents to be unlikable. Historically, they've been hatchet men.
Spiro Agnew. Spiro Agnew.
Spiro Agnew, you know, calling the media nattering nabobs
of negativity.
Yeah, and of course you had Bob Dole was Gerald Ford's running mate in 1976, and he was a real hatchet man for Dole. But these two guys, I mean, Vance is dislikable or unlikable for a whole host of reasons, and I think it should be obvious. Walz, on the other hand, you know, I used to be a teacher, and of course, so was Tim Walz.
Okay.
And I knew a lot of people who remind me, a lot of people in the profession who reminded me of Tim Walz. They were kind of hotshot, bombastic. You know how they say, well, you're a sports guy also.
Yeah.
You know how they say that somebody is like a player's coach?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
No,
yeah,
somebody that the players just love.
Yeah.
He was one of those teachers that the students just loved. And that's good in some ways because you can get more out of students if they love you.
Yeah.
But what kind of things do you have to do in order to get the students to love you?
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to do things that maybe you shouldn't do with them. I'm not talking about anything illegal,
sure.
but things maybe you're too permissive.
Uh-huh.
Maybe you're too much like their friend when you really shouldn't be their friend. I run into a lot of folks like that when I was teaching who were like Tim Walz. And of course, he's misrepresented his military service as well.
Mm-hmm.
But he's certainly not the first person to pat his resume.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I don't know as I would fault him too much for that. But this is going to be, I mean, I cover politics and I write about it, so I have to watch it.
And the microphones will not be muted here. They will be open, which should be interesting.
Oh, so they can interrupt each other.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Well, should be cool.
And the big controversy now, of course, is fact checker. You know, should they be fact checking in real time, the moderators? I think, frankly, puts too much pressure on the moderators to fact check on the flight.
Mm-hmm.
On the fly, do that later online, or let the candidates fact check each other.
And
I'm looking forward to this, even as much as I hate it. I have a love-hate relationship.
And Terry, what you just mentioned brought up a memory. I think it was Bill Parcells who said, "Beware of a player's coach, because that means he's soft." Parcells said that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've seen that so much. Some of the teachers I know who were like students' teachers, they would say things like, "Oh, well, you know, I'm not good at discipline. I leave that to other people."
Oh boy,
which is basically saying we have to do all the hard work while you have fun with the kids.
Yeah,
great.
All right,
okay.
Terry Cowgill, thank you. Enjoy the debate tomorrow night, and we'll check back. Thank you, sir. Be good.
All right, you too, Paul.
All right, Terry Cowgill, there.